is a spicy one.
Because of my camera moving into my legs. That's why. All right. If you can, that's an incentive to watch this this episode. If you can spot how many times my camera is moving down to my shorts as I move my head, and leave us a voice message to tell me how many times it happened, you're a good student.
Yeah. That way. Oh shit! That's completely fair. So Kevin has just left us. Kevin Adam, and we had a really good chat. It was actually really cool. It's one of those ones where we like got into it and we're like the first 10 or 15 minutes talking about like team management and, you know, how to do that. And it was just a really interesting, like fully flowing chat where it was just like a conversation between three marketers, and they're my favorite ones. I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there about the industry and teams, and there's some funny bits as well, which is good.
Yeah, his career going from, starting in marketing all the way to head of growth, big team, small team, management, paid media, CRM. Like, he works in really cool companies as well. So we talk about Eat, the Mystery Box fashion company. We talk about List, fashion marketplace. We don't talk about Cover, but we worked at Cover as well in the paid performance marketing team. Cover is a car insurance. We did talk about it a little bit, but we mentioned it a little bit. But yeah, he worked with a really cool company. Now he works at Drew, the art. Is it a marketplace as well? Is it art marketplace?
It's like an e-com, I think.
Like e-com, art income company. So yeah, like very cool name, cool industries, very, very nice guy. And it went really fast. It's a nice little jam session with Kevin. I'm glad we connected and spoke to him. So I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Make sure you follow the podcast. Comes every week. It will help us continue growing. If you also leave a review, 5 stars only. And if you're on Spotify, you can watch it. We actually got our first voice message through the show notes. There's a link at the bottom of the show notes. Even on Apple, you can click on it and you can leave us an audio message, whatever you want. You can trash us, say something nice.
Roast us.
And we'll listen to all of them, engage with them. Maybe put some of them on the pod if they're funny. Feel free to leave us a message that will make us smile and show your support.
Put your headphones in, snuggle up with us, and let's have a nice conversation.
Nice blanket of marketing talks.
Yeah, with you and your shorts.
Gosh.
Oh.
Hey Kevin.
We like as always, we're such in a rush. So yeah, Jake just connected just a second ago and it was like, we're just freestyling our way into podcasting.
I literally got home from the office and ran up the stairs and then it's time to do a podcast.
Oh wow. That's the life.
That's the price to pay to run a successful marketing podcast in 2024. Thank you for joining us into the pod. I feel like we've been connected for a while, but we actually never spoke. So it's actually nice to meet you officially and get to jam on some marketing topics together, the three of us for an hour, and so I'm looking forward to it.
I didn't even know you had a French accent. I've known you for so long, but I'd never heard you speak.
Yeah, I've got a French accent. Wait, are you French too?
No, definitely not.
No. Yeah, no, I do have still a bit of a French accent. Accents are funny because some people I meet, they I don't know if they're nice or if people hear differently, but they don't hear the accent. And some people
don't
are like,
tell
straight
me
away.
Some people say you don't have an accent.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
What the fuck?
They just think you're from like East London or something.
Maybe they're nice, or maybe they just got like shit earrings. Whatever. As a little intro, do you want to tell us, you know, like a little overview about like your career and where you worked? Because I think you've got a very interesting journey into now being head of growth. Yeah. But like, how did you get there? And we can talk about these roles a little bit more in detail. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. So I think it almost kind of starts at university randomly. So I studied literature at uni. And then on my last day, so I wanted to be like a writer. I wanted to be like script writer. And I want to work for like the BBC and stuff like that.
Nice.
I did like a project where you write a script for EastEnders. Just weird stuff like that. and then on my last course, on my last like lecture, a lecturer was like, "Oh, you guys know like you're never gonna make any money being writers, right?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." It kind of just hit me. So I need to find like something that pays.
They saved that till the last day, man.
Yeah, they saved that till the last day.
By the way.
And then so I was like, well, I need to find something. So luckily I was like kind of like interning a little bit, and I ended up interning at Nike and Converse a little bit. And then I went up to Manchester, then I went to intern at Foot Asylum. And I came back down, I was like, I was a waiter at the time, like, I'm never gonna be a waiter ever again. I was like, I wanna get into marketing, that's kinda like my calling. Then I worked at a company called List for about 4.5 years. So List is like a fashion, I probably shouldn't say it's like Farfetch, but it's kind of like Farfetch. as a fashion, a huge marketplace for luxury fashion. Worked there for a while, kind of like learn kind of like just the ropes around marketing. I work with like still like the best managers I've ever had, kind of the best team I've ever had, just really people that just knew everything that you needed to know. And after that, kind of like spread my wings, worked at a company called Cover, which is like an insurance company, very different to like luxury fashion, but kind of gave me like a bit of a different light into what marketing was. And also marketing for like the everyman, like no one needs like designer clothes, but everyone needs car insurance. So it kind of gave me like a different perspective on how to like communicate with people and communicate with an audience. I went back to fashion again. I worked at a company called Heat. Or close to like just 18 months. That was my first head of growth role in there. Kind of like take everything by the reins, every aspect from digital marketing, CRM, like working with the product team, kind of the whole circle of things. And like, it was like definitely an experience, which was great. Really cool. And then recently just started at a company called Drool, which has been awesome, which Drool's an art company, kind of working with emerging artists to sell their work, kind of like democratizing fine art, I suppose is kind of like the hook I kind of like for it. It's been exciting and kind of getting into
amazing.
I've heard great stuff, has been awesome.
Yeah. How big is it, Drool? Is it quite new or not?
Yeah, so Drool's been going on for around, I think maybe like 2019 onwards. It's a relatively lean team, like 15 to 20 people. Yeah. Which is great. Kind of getting in there and taking the growth role kind of a bit more, kind of stuff that I've learned within it, but then also adding a bit of flavor as well.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, so quite a few years. You mentioned the best team or the best managers you work with at List. Why do you think that was that made them the best?
I think it's people that can do the best job of like teaching you up and then leaving and then trusting you to do what you want to do as well. You kind of have like it's almost like the hands off micromanagers who like micromanage you, but then when you ask them, it's like, this is you're the lead on this, you figure it out. So it's the kind of, they don't kind of know how to strike that balance, and like they strike a really good balance of like they taught you up, but then they gave you like the real ownership at the same time. And that was kind of like really awesome. And also they kind of took the hits that, you know, the heads off would kind of like trickle down to you. And they took those hits so that you didn't have to. And then you kind of only realize that when you leave, it's like, wow, that guy really was looking out for me. And you kind of don't realize that until you're dealing with it yourself.
Do you, did you apply some of that since in the roles you had after? Did you manage any, are you managing or did you manage people since?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was definitely the biggest thing I wanted to move on from, like anywhere that I went was like, how do I replicate, you know, I've been good, like blessed enough to have like really good managers kind of brought me to the level that I think I'm at. And I kind of felt like a sense of duty to do that for like the next generation of marketers too. So it's kind of always been my ethos, and you know, whoever I work with as a team or who I lead as a team, kind of bringing that, you know, empowering them to kind of be the best versions of themselves.
Yeah. It's not easy as well, you know, like it's not easy to not micromanage too much, you know, when you know what needs to be done, but someone else has to do it.
Yeah.
You have to kind of like put them in the right path if they're not already on the right path. Show them the way, but not do it for them. So it's definitely good to do, but it's not necessarily easy for everyone to apply.
I would think the hardest thing to delegate to someone is something that you can picture exactly how you would do it in your head. Mm-hmm. So it's like when you've got too much to do and you're like, oh, fuck, I could do all of these things, but I have to give this one away to someone, and then they do it and they get back to you and you're like,
it's not easy.
I'm gonna redo some of that.
It's not easy, but I feel like some domains, so like I don't know, more in the data side, insight side of things, like it's often like there's one answer, there's one way of doing it because it's like presenting data or whatever it is. So like that you can teach someone if they don't know, but also they eventually they know how to do it, and that's it. What becomes really tricky with that stuff is in marketing is all the creative things. Because all the creative things, there's a million ways to attack it. And when you think about, I don't know, social content or something that you want to try because you think it might get a bit more traction or go viral or whatever, you can't just, in that philosophy, you can't just come to your team members and be like, just do this. You know, show them the example and be like, just do this. You have to like tell them like, have you seen this trend or have you seen this? And then you let them execute. And that's where what you have in mind and what they come up with as a solution can be very different. And like, you can't be mad at that. It's like, you know, interpretations of things, creativity can be a bit tricky for that particular bit.
The other side, the end of the spectrum is when you have somebody who is like that unicorn person on your team. So I have one of those right now. Shout out, Izzy. Mm. And I'll give her like the lightest brief of something to do. And she knows me now. So she'll just be like, okay, I'm not going to ask for like too much details. And she'll go and do it. And then she'll be like a day later, she'll be like, I've done that. And I'll have a look and be like 10 times longer than what I was expecting. And I'm like, it's putting me to shame. So that's when you find with someone like that, you got to hold on to them.
It's great. I think that's what we were talking about as well, Johan, beforehand, is like I wonder what your guys view on is like the size of a team. Sometimes it's like, sometimes when you just have like just you and two, like comes like a duo, you're kind of working in tandem, each person kind of gets the other person's style to a certain point as well, and then you kind of know like this is how Johan wants, this is how Jake would like it, and then you also know vice versa. How do you guys feel about like the big team versus like the micro team?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can, there obviously comes a point where it like has to be a big team, I guess. But certainly I've been in a position where the team is like too big. So you've like joined and it's like way too big. And that is a difficult position to be in. Especially when you're like trying to find things for people to do. Like the nicest thing is when you can like get into that flow when like everyone can just take this, take that. Like you say, Kevin, everyone knows each other's strengths and weaknesses and can kind of take things from each other. I think when I think of a team, I never think of it as like, I'm the leader of the team. If I'm in that situation of being the team lead today, it's like, I don't want to be dishing out work or telling people what to do and all that kind of stuff. And like the management, people management stuff that comes with it is cool. But for me, it's like, I don't see in that example, Izzy as like, under me in the team. She's just the team with me. And sometimes I might have to guide her on some things, but that's how I try and get to. But it takes a lot of time. It doesn't always work like that. It's really hard. Like, hiring people is super hard. You go through as many rounds of tasks and shit as you want. But in the end, you never truly know how somebody works until you actually start working with them. So it's difficult.
Yeah, I think I think it's a different job. I think when you get to like big team in a much bigger company, I think the role becomes very different. The title might be the same, but the role is very different. So I think it depends on who you are as an individual, like what you want as your job to be. And that can also change over time. I know right now for me, like I like small teams and small, lean team to be able to like execute much faster and like get to results a lot faster. But, I know from experience that when you get to a company that gets to like a scale up or bigger, it gets really hard to push the right decision through and actually execute on them without any ideas to be like shut down in the process of validating it or change to the point that it doesn't even make sense anymore or doesn't have any impact. And then the whole masquerade at the end of the campaign to like having to justify why it's still a good thing that we did it. Well, clearly it's not, but you have to like save face and, you know, to like, because you're like, I don't know, you protect your job or something. So yeah, I think it's a personality thing. Some people are really good at that and they want that. But I also think in the last 2 years, a lot of companies have gone back to small teams. And I think for the foreseeable future, we're going to go more and more in that direction. So I think being comfortable with small teams and also doing the work as well as your team or part of it is going to become more and more common. So I feel like even though the times are harder for companies and startups and anyone really in the business world, and our marketing team have less budget, et cetera, it's good to have been able to work in small teams because I think it's the trend now. What do you think, Kevin?
I agree. I think I've had like every aspect of a 200 company team, then a 71, then a 10, 15, 5. I've actually preferred the smaller ones. I feel like you just get so much more stuff done. And it's like kind of like less red tape. I think the pros and cons of like with a smaller company is really nowhere to hide. You either get this, I don't know if I can swear on this.
Go for it.
You either get the shit done, like, or you don't. Versus, in a bigger team, there's more room to hide, but it's also like kind of a lot of fluff kind of goes in between it. And I don't know, you kind of just cut through it a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of stuff that comes, in my experience, when you're managing a team, as soon as you get to like you plus three other people, that's when it gets really hard to, it's like that's when the drama, you got progression and you got people wanting to do different things. And any one time you got someone who's like pissed off with the direction of the company or angry at the team or something they said, like didn't get seen through to the end, and you got to like try and keep them in the company. And then next minute that you've sorted that out and then you get someone messaging you like, oh, I'm thinking about like handing in my notice. You're like, fucking hell. And as me and you have said in the past, like, for both of us, I don't know about you, Kevin, but I am not as keen to do like, I'm happy to do people management as part of a small team, but I don't want it to get to a point where that becomes more than 50% of my job. Yep. My favorite part of a team is when I can be part of the team actually doing the stuff and keeping hands to keyboard as well. And I think Yo feels the same as that. I don't know. What do you think about that, Kevin?
I don't know when I'll move away from being like super hands-on. I actually kind of like really like it to a point. It's like, am I a bit of a control freak kind of thing? But I don't know. I just kind of enjoy it so much. I think it keeps me a bit sharp and kind of like just on the day-to-day tool stuff. Yeah. I had like a friend who was like an engineer, and he was like, I don't want to be like a, you know, head of engineering, because that means I'm in meetings every single day and I'm not actually like on my desk doing what I love to do. And I think I kind of have the same ethos like on my side. I don't have like marketing kind of, you kind of definitely be in, on the fluffy side sometimes of marketing, but I want to be like an engineer level marketer where like I'm just at my desk, just like churning away at stuff and not making pitch decks every 10 minutes.
That makes sense. Exactly. I feel like we're the same. So you came up in a few roles from starting, I think you said at Converse, all the way to now being head of growth in like quite a few companies. Like, did you have like a strategy to get there? Do you think there is like a few things that you've done that were like the right thing, the right move to like grow in your career in the last few years?
Yeah, I think it was. Well, I think first, like my manager at List was like, "What do you want to?" When I first was like, "What do you want to do?" I was like, "I want to be the CMO of Coca-Cola." I didn't even know what that meant. I think it just sounded cool just to say. I was that. But I think what I realized was like actually like specializing in something and being like the go-to person for that. So like, I like cut my teeth at like paid social. I was using like Meta, or back when it was called Facebook, when like interest targeting was a thing, and it's not anymore. And that was kind of like my like bread and butter, and that's what I focused on. And luckily enough, like that's become so much bigger, like, you know, like close to 10 years later, and I've kind of like etched out like a space within that. And I understand like the platform, but then also like upskilled on the creativity side, on like the visual identity side of things. But then I think at the core, when, you know, when someone are looking for like a head of growth, they're looking for like a good paid media person at like for the most part.
A lot of time.
And, you know, I think that's probably a pro and a con. I think that's like a whole nother like discussion around like what is a head of growth, to be honest. But yeah, that's was kind of my angle, kind of a specializing in something, but then like upskilling on the side on other things that I thought would like benefit that role in general.
What was the? That's cool. That's similar to very similar to myself and Jake. That's how we started when we started working together a bit more than 10 years ago now. What other channels did you add to paid social after that? Do you have like do you remember like which one you added over the last few years from that
in paid social or just in...
Oh. Outside of paid social, in like other channels, other acquisition or else?
I think affiliate was one that was a weird one. I think affiliate was kind of like going out of the space and it's kind of being reimagined a little bit now. Like affiliate is influencer marketing a bit, and then like TikTok Shop is kind of like delving into that a bit. And then CRM was like a big one that I kind of like delved into a lot more. Like my previous place, Heat, was a very much a CRM focused company, and that's something that it made those two marry. So like, you know, paid social was kind of like that lead gen arm for it, but then CRM as well, like we drove a lot of the conversion and the revenue. So really understanding what drove someone to, you know, want to purchase from a Meta side, but then also like really sharpening up those CRM skills on a Klaviyo, for example, to actually get them to convert. And that was a much more, because of the price point of Heat, it became a much more considered purchase. So it was like AOV was like £400 or like $500. So, you know, that was there's a lot of consideration within that, and CRM was kind of like the best channel for that. But really pushing on that was kind of like a big thing for me, and then moving into like other places
That's cool. Yeah, I think CRM is a massively not underutilized, but it's just not discussed. Like for whatever reason, it's not seen as being like as sexy to talk about CRM as it is for like every other discipline, which I think is, you know, sucks, because there's so much you can do there and it's so important. And it's like the foundation for so many, like effectively every business that relies on repeat purchases, right? Yeah. I mean, every business in general, but it's more, we need to make CRM sexy again.
Yeah, that's
get
the
on a t-shirt.
Can that be the episode?
Yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
the mix here, I'm sexy again. I think some of these chats, I was thinking about that, like why, not every time, but in a lot of businesses, CRM is like this like dry, very dry thing that is very transactional, very like, you know, flow based. There's no like, it feels like there's no emotion to it. And I think one of my theory, I don't know if I'm right with this, but maybe you can jump on this after I said it. But I think a lot of these channels in digital marketing are so new in comparison to everything else. Like they just appeared like 10, 15 years ago. Like it's all fairly recent. And in a lot of cases, these channels were added like, you know, one after the other in like kind of in silo, right? It's like now we can do emails. So email became the thing. And in the case of CRM or emails, I feel like the type of people that went into it up until now, they're very like data, almost like like almost like engineers, like they think about it, they think about conversions, but not, they don't think about people, if that makes sense, you know. They think about optimization as opposed to the emotion that someone will feel when they see the email and the title and stuff. Like everything is an optimization as opposed to maybe a feeling. Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, but I think it's changing. And I think guys like you, Kevin, and like understanding other channels and becoming end of growth, like you can connect those things a bit better. And yeah. I think that makes the channel go up, go in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like we've always kind of said like the marketing funnel. And I feel like marketing is not a funnel, it's more like a cycle. And you start at one and then you move to the other and then you kind of just kind of keep on ever going. Like a funnel kind of indicates that you just stop and you just never come back again. Whereas a more of like a, it's an ongoing process. And I think that's the way we need to look at it now. And like you said, like, you know, CRM, for example, has kind of lived in silo where all of these kind of like platforms need to like work in unison more so because one impacts you. If you look at like, you know, meta attribution, like on its own, the person living in South London.
If it's not me, it's you. So don't worry, Kevin. It'll be me next turn. Next police car will be me.
But yeah, if you look at like, you know, like if you ever use like Triple Whale or something like that, like it will always kind of show like all your conversions came from whatever the last touch point is. But like, it's not actually the case. You kind of know like that played a part. A bit of organic played a part, a bit of email played a part. It's everything that works together. Like you can't like always like attribute it just as one thing. And we kind of need to start looking at it within that sense of like customers have multiple touch points. So we need to kind of like acknowledge that and then create a strategy off the back of that as well.
Yeah. I wanted to like change subject, but you mentioned heat. One of the thing that is quite connected between you and me, I think, is I was working with them as a like freelance, like consultant with Joe.
Oh, wow.
I think up until, I think 2 months after, then you joined them full time at that point. Yeah. But I found it, the few months I helped them, I found it quite fascinating because like for people who don't know what it is, can you tell us the business model, how it works? And also like, let's talk about how did you find working there and, you know, working on the CRM, etc.
Yeah. So he is a luxury fashion mystery box platform. So kind of like the hook of it is the two founders, Joe and Mario, basically find like a niche in a market where like brands had also like this massive like problem with brands kind of like overstock. And they would never like put those products ever on discount. Brands like Burberry like historically would like either destroy products or end up like in like the gray market or somewhere like a warehouse in China or something like that. And instead they kind of approached those brands and said, why don't we put it in a mystery box where the pricing is opaque? So you don't really have an idea of the pricing. So a box would cost £299. But then the value of it would be 2 to 3 times the cost of the box. And it's not that it was like, you know, like old, bad stock. It was just an issue of like just overconsumption aspect. And also brands don't want to devalue their product by ever seeing it on sale as well. So yeah, the guys founded it back in 2019, I want to say, kind of like pre-COVID, and blew up massively. LVMH one of the key investors. Just kind of snowballed after that. It was an interesting time. I think, that was kind of my first foray into working in like a smaller team, which comes with like its pros and cons. But I think that was probably like the most pivotal time for me, because it kind of woke me up into like, okay, this is like the training wheels are off now. This is kind of how.
In the deep end.
Exactly.
Did you only do CRM, or you also delved into the paid social?
Paid social, CRM. One of the interesting was like you got really hacky in there. So like doing drops like in like Facebook groups, like did a like with like Stone Island, and that we did a Vetmons drop, and kind of like really dove into like Reddit, and kind of like did a bit of Discord, kind of like really getting into like this like streetwear subculture.
The cook groups.
Yeah, exactly. Coming to that understanding, you know, there's so much more, there's a more considered audience outside of just like Meta, for example. And even a group that might have like 10,000 followers is way more engaged than like 10,000 impressions on a Meta ad or something.
I've got to say, I just remembered the one thing I didn't like about Joe. So if Joe's listening to this episode, this is a reminder. One of the things that we talked about when I was working with him was that I would get a free box every month, and I never got a bloody box.
Oh, you never got a box?
I need to follow up with him, and I'll be like, well, where are the boxes, man? Did you get some boxes?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
I got a few stuff. I think most of like my wardrobe for the past like 18 months was like via Heat.
Nice. All Palmen gels, Vetements, Off-White.
A little bit. I'm not a big Off-White guy though. We did a box called like the Contemporary Box, which is like non-branded. It was interesting because like, that was like non-branded stuff, which was like very much a different audience. So that was the stuff that I liked. Nice. But the core customer did not like that stuff.
My favorite thing about this conversation so far is that when Yo was just talking about getting a box, his camera panned down and then zoomed in between his legs.
He's
wearing shorts.
Look, the legs are out.
It's interesting, Kevin, because our careers have been like fairly similar industry wise. So I was at Net-a-Porter when you were at List, then I went onto a streetwear marketplace called Bump. So you know, there's a lot of overlap, and really interesting. Something you just said there that some people might not necessarily get if they haven't worked for a luxury brand is that the concept that you can't just go into sale when you're having trouble, even as a reseller, and you can't discount products. There's so many occasions and products being sent off and like being completely de-tagged and debadged and destroyed just because going on sale is the last thing that, you know, Burberry want to do or Gucci would ever do, because it just devalues the brand entirely. So there's so many things that you're limited from doing. The same as when, if you work for a marketplace like List, as you'll know, you can't, there's a lot of brands where you just have a verbal agreement that you won't beat them to like position one in the search results. Yeah. So if you're searching for like a certain item, you'll get an email from like the team at Gucci, and they're like, you've overstepped the mark. And you're like, oh, sorry, we have to like reduce the bid to get down. So it's a really interesting industry, isn't it, for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's crazy. You literally have like contracts and agreements saying like you won't like outbid them, stuff like that, which is
it's weird. Yeah.
So it was funny because like we did, well, I don't know if anyone's gonna hit, I feel like we did way better like paid marketing than those brands, but like we weren't allowed to like supersede them because of like the agreement that we had.
But I mean, you can't even, most of those, you can't even shop on their sites anyway. So it's like.
The worst ever.
What I liked about it is the the funnel that they build with SMS and like building leads and stuff. Like, can you walk us through that a little bit? Because yeah, I think when I was there, they had like a huge amount of like phone numbers and stuff, and it was all like dropped through SMS and emails. But yeah, was it still the case when you were there? Like
Exactly. So when I joined, that was kind of like I said, that was like the big proportion of like driving revenue on drop day at Heat. One thing that I found interesting was, you know, when I joined, like there was, again, Meta had changed in those like last few years, where like you could kind of get a lot of leads, like emails and SMS, like just optimizing towards lead. But then that was like slowly changing and started moving towards optimizing towards like purchase. Which became like the biggest thing, where it's like, you know, you can get less like phone numbers or like emails, but you get way more high intent customers. So that's one of the things that I changed strategy was like it was an intent game, not a volume game, and that kind of changed everything. And where we'd end up spending less, having less signups, but the conversion rate was like 3 times higher than it, which was really awesome to see. And then yeah, SMS was kind of, that was like my first point to understand like how powerful SMS was. That's like 80% of revenue came from SMS. But we had, that was like a third of, you know, like the whole CRM database. It's so powerful. And then I moved into us using WhatsApp as kind of a channel for that. It became like this one-to-one communications thing, which was amazing because you could do so much more with that. It was, you could send like a PDF of the drop of like the catalog. People could like ask questions. I had like the WhatsApp on my phone, and people would like try and call me, which was, I had to like take that off like soon after. But it was so interesting because you started realizing just how powerful SMS as a channel is. And that's kind of the one thing. If you're in a D2C space, you have to like at least try it or do it, because you'd be surprised like what it can drive.
For sure.
Interesting. And was that kind of built into your like your CRM journeys? So, you know, a drop will go out, they'd get an email about it, they'd get an SMS about it.
Yeah, exactly. That was within a sign up. So you'd put in your email and your number, and then you'd get put into the flows immediately. What we thought was kind of better was to let SMS be more of the point of conversion. So that's, you get that on drop day, but then in the lead up to the drop, email was kind of like the core, you know, understanding the drop a bit more.
So you don't spam them too much.
Yeah, exactly. Don't spam them too much. You get more of a visual idea from the email versus like SMS just being like a link, basically.
That's cool. It's also like, it makes it feel a bit exclusive, doesn't it? It's like the drop's here right now. You just get the text.
It has like a supreme kind of feel to it on like a push notification or something.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's cool. I think lead gen is, you know, for most of my career, I've been like not done any things to do with lead gen and not really been too interested in it, but I think as a channel it's like, sorry, not as a channel, as like an industry or whatever you want to call it, a business, it probably covers the widest array of like marketing channels effectively. You know, you have to be shit hot on CRM, you have to be excellent at your paid acquisition, you have to have a team, you know, you have to be probably doing some form of direct sales. I think if you work for a lead gen business or have a lead gen client, then there's a shitload of stuff you can learn in a short period of time that you just wouldn't get to touch in anything else. Like just like SMS, for instance, right? That's a perfect channel, but you probably wouldn't be doing that. We weren't doing SMS at Net-a-Porter, for instance. So it's, I think it's a really interesting space. And as more and more companies do bake some kind of subscription into their business model, then it's just like everything's becoming a lead gen company, basically.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking about. Yeah, like I think SMS can be, I receive some weird texts sometimes from like businesses I shouldn't receive texts from, you know, like, so I think it can be overused or misused. But if you've got, like you said, some sort of subscription or a special drop, like Eat, I think there's some application where it works really, really well, because the difference between an SMS and an email is that the open rate is going to be almost 100%.
Yeah.
So your coverage is huge. If what you're delivering in the SMS is of value and timely, everyone's going to open it. So yeah, can be, it's like, that is not a small difference. That makes a huge difference for a business. So yeah.
And WhatsApp is, sorry, Kevin, go.
No, I was going to say, yeah, you can literally like 3x your click-through rate comparison on SMS to like CRM. Yeah. You're talking about like maybe 1% to 2% click-through rate on email, but like 7%, 8% on SMS. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
That is mad. And also just the ease of sharing on let's say like WhatsApp, for instance, mm-hmm. and the one-to-many nature of that, right? So you get a WhatsApp, you forward it into a group with like 20 of your friends in it. That's like, it's a real like catalyst for virality you can have in there.
Yeah, that's a cool one. That's a cool one. Did you, I was curious to know if you were involved in SEO at all when you were at List. Because that was the bread and butter.
Yeah. So like, not so much. So when I joined, I actually joined, going back to, you know, I joined as a copywriter, kind of pushing as like writing was kind of what I knew, but I never really dove into like the SEO side of things. But yeah, SEO was like a huge aspect of List kind of like in the early days. That was a Simon Dance, kind of like the guru behind that.
Shout out Simon.
You need to get him on here. That's the real OG.
I know him actually. So yeah, I need to invite him. I'll bring him on board. Yeah. I think I told that story on the podcast. But when I was at Depop before he moved that List, I think it was at Amazon. I think I didn't say that story because I didn't want to like out him out. But it's been so many years now. Now it's fine. But yeah, he was helping us on the SEO strategy side of things for Depop back in those days. Wow. And then he moved that List and killed it. Absolutely killed it.
I was
impressed. When I met him, I was like, you know, when you think you're okay, you know, you think you're like, you're doing good in marketing. And so you meet someone like him and you're like, I don't know shit. Like, there's some guys or another, it's another level. There's another level to this video game, but
that's still a mystical channel as well, though, isn't it? I mean, there's like so much depth and like unknowns and
I think
SEO, it's like
I think a guy like him, though, what he was doing and what he's still doing is like they can spot businesses that have SEO potential that can be engineered, not just SEO by writing articles around the topic. That's like like any business can do that. You pick a few keywords and you write content around that, and that's it's cute, you know. But it's not like what he was able to spot is like, no, you're a marketplace. All these pages can be indexed, can be automated. You can have like hundreds of thousands, millions of pages that are all getting traffic, da 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 da, and all the engineering behind that and estimating the traffic over time, like all this sort of analysis, man, that I've never been an expert on. But when I was talking to him in those days, got to see like literally like shadowing his mind. I was like, this is wild, this is crazy. And even I think even to this day, there's a lot of businesses that have SEO, like deep SEO potential, but they don't tap into it. Another great example is like the Canva example. Like Canva smashed it on SEO because of all the templates. Like they managed to create traffic across like thousands and thousands of like templatable pages and generate business off the back of that. But yeah, I think it's a combination of having like a great SEO mind and also the business that goes with it that can apply these things, which is not every business's. But yeah, super interesting.
Yeah, I think it's so much more technical than people kind of give it credit for. Like you said, like it's so much more. I think that's like level one of the game if you're writing articles, especially in 2024. There's like so much of an in-depth level that comes to SEO that like, I mean, it's engineering to a certain aspect, and I think it's a handful of people that really get it and know what they're doing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a business that doesn't have like deep SEO potential, the next level that you could do today is use, and we spoke about that with with Cody actually in one of the previous episodes, where now you can use AI to build a few thousand articles in the space of a few hours. That would build your whole like content library of like a topic for you. It won't be perfect, but at least it will be live and it'll start being indexed and it'll start getting traffic eventually. That's something that any business could do today. You don't have to have a big team or to hire like 10 content writers. You could just do that with one person and some AI tools, basically. But that's still not like the Canva or the List or the, you know, Depop marketplace type of business that can go even like deeper with that stuff. But yeah, there's some evolution to help you do that nowadays. Yeah.
What was like some of the biggest wins that you saw, like in your, like the one that you'd like, you hang up on your trophy, be like, yeah, that was me. Like I did that. I know you're
the, the list of losses is bigger than the list of wins. That's a sign of a true growth marketer, guys. Come on. I would say, I think the one that had the most immediate impact was that we, it's from the SEO side as well, actually. We rolled out web shopping at Bump Street, where marketplace, it was mobile only. We were getting a lot of traffic to the homepage. I was like, we've got a shitload of products here. We just need to get them on a web view and have people be able to shop on web. And like overnight went to like the main revenue driving channel, which was crazy. But I mean, it was obvious from the numbers. You didn't take rocket scientist to work that out, but that was a big one.
For me, that's a good question, Kevin. Thank you for asking. No, I think the most recent one that I can remember. The what did you say? You did that French voice from SpongeBob. Yeah. It was at Nude, actually. We never spend as much as a normal fintech in the UK, which most of them have a shit ton of money to spend. But we managed very early on to crack like working with creators and some influencers, but mostly just content creators. And very quickly managed to get like such a cheap top of funnel traffic off the back of these videos. A lot of them went viral, like millions of views on TikTok, on like a product that is for first-time home buyers, which is like, first of all, the most annoying topic for like Gen Z and stuff, because no one can say if it's really hard. Like, you know, like, so we managed to make it connect and get the views, get the traffic and convert that into customers, to the point that for a fairly long period of time, we were in the top 20 financial app with like literally spending just a few hundred pounds every day, which is nothing. Wow. Compared to most fintechs. But I think a lot of other fintechs, all they were doing at the time, and a lot of them still do to this day, they were just showing their debit cards, you know, against the sky, you know, like whatever. Like we all seen those ads, like from like Monzo, Revolut, and stuff. But the even though they are not competitors, the problem with that is that I think they can afford to pay 10 times more than we couldn't afford to pay that price. So we had to find a way to get it cheaper. So I think that was like in the recent years, that was my biggest win with the team. That was awesome. And it still works, but you know, we don't have as much budget these days. So it's just less impactful, but yeah, it was good. It was good. Good question.
The struggle.
What's yours, Kevin?
Oh, for me, you know what? It's going to be really embarrassing. Cause I feel like my best one was like, maybe close to a decade ago now.
No, it's good, man. It's good. Own it.
So we were launching the List app. It wasn't a decade ago. I think we were like 2019 or something like that. And like, you know, like installs were like just like way too high. And I actually stole this from Nike. I remember I was on Facebook and I like saw like Nike basically made their DPA. So that's dynamic product ads for anyone. As an app install. So they just like basically put the whole catalog, and when you clicked on it, you'd take it to the app store. and then you'd install it. So, but List has like 16 million products. So like we were like way ahead of that. So I just wanted to imagine like, I think I can unlock it. I think I'll figure something out. So we just made our DPAs deep linked to the app. So as soon as you clicked on that like product, it'll take you to the app store, you download it, and then it will take you straight to that product and then you can buy it straight away. I don't know if that's like, I don't know. I definitely didn't like revolutionize it, but I still like hold that as like my one win. Like,
yeah,
I'm talking about that for years.
Yeah, man, that is nice. And so many, you know, that, well, for a start, it's much more difficult to do that kind of deep linking now of all like the issues with Apple and stuff. But so many companies didn't do that kind of stuff for such a long time. I mean, like, you see an ad, you click it, you install the app, and you're just sitting on the homepage. You're like, how do I find that thing that you're just telling me about?
Exactly.
So no, I think that's a great one. There's a big catalog. Just on a nerdy note, like what did you guys use as like the catalog management tool for that? If you remember.
Oh man, I think that's like more of like a tech team question. How did they do it? It was something on the back end. I'll ask my like data friends. They're way more smarter than me to answer that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Shout out Products Up. And Ed Puzzle used this thing called Products Up, and it was so nice. Anyway, it's too boring to explain. I'll cut this whole section out. But it was like a third party tool. So you like connect it to your back end and all the products go into it. And instead of having to like change your, because you know, like you want to put your products on Facebook, you need to have, you know, you need to pass like three images and they need to be in this size and whatever. You would go into Products Up and you would say, create like a new thing that pulled in this image and then like adjusted the size of it and then layered this price on the top of it. And you could like create all your templates in it.
Oh, wow.
And then it would like spit it out to Facebook, or it'd like auto optimize to show your best products in the feed and stuff. It was wicked. It was like such a good tool. But anyway, if anyone wants a product management tool, look up Products Up. But Kevin, we're kind of getting up to the end of it, but I really want to talk about Drawl, because I think it's pretty cool and I've actually used it myself and I've got some prints from it. And that seems like a company that will be using DPAs or whatever they're called now to the extreme.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. So we're doing like a mixed bag of that. It's interesting because I feel like that's something that works like in different parts of the funnel. So people that kind of already know what they want, we kind of see like a nice pickup on there, but we do use it like kind of like on the top of funnel as well. But what's actually really working is like still creator led content. I feel like things have changed now where like companies, they more so want like a creative director versus like a person that like gets like paid media as a whole. It's kind of like this hybrid role now where like you're briefing in, you're communicating with creators, you're thinking of like new interesting ways to like communicate your products versus just doing like the old school product ads. But that, it still has a place, but it's more so like a little bit further down the funnel.
Yeah. And how did you find adapting to this new kind of role? I feel like it does have to come from someone who understands advertising to begin with, or marketing to begin with, to adapt to that. Someone who comes purely from the creative side of things. I think it's not impossible, but it would be harder to adapt to like, what's gonna get clicked on, or you know, what people are gonna engage. How is it for you?
Yeah. I think it's been helpful because I think, like I said, it's almost like a hybrid role now where like, I learned like my data side of things, like at List. I like learned how to like work with creators at Cover, like working like we like blew up on TikTok as well. I learned more like the brand side, the CRM side at Heat, and then kind of just bringing it all together. It's so much more than just like your typical media buyer now. That it's not like that anymore. It's a creative media buyer / growth hacker, like all rolled into one. You kind of need to be really be switched on across like the whole thing.
That makes sense.
In the words of Chris Winterhoff a few episodes ago, creative performance marketer.
I like that. That's a good one.
Yeah. And talking about titles, you mentioned this other debate, which is an interesting one, but like, what is a head of growth today? Like, what is it for you?
A head of growth is someone that just gets shit done, like on the market. That's all it is. It's just, it's just a title. It's just like a good marketer that's kind of like been through the trenches and now kind of can call themselves the head of growth.
Yeah. It's like it's an earn title. I hate that debate though. Like, you know, a lot of times on LinkedIn, like it feels quite a snobby kind of discussion. It's like who can call themselves this or that, and it's a bit of the same for like CMOs and stuff. Like, and depending on who says this, like, you know, it's the old school growth person that comes from product. So like, if you're too much of a marketer, you can't be a head of growth. And you know, if it's the old school CMO, like that does a lot of branding. If you like talk too much about ads or acquisition, it's like you can't be a CMO because like we're above that, you know. Not that. I hate that debate. It's absolute nonsense. So I like your definition of it. For me, it's like I'll be whoever you want me to be, you know. Like I adapt. It really depends on the business as well, you know. Like a lot of businesses are focusing on acquisition and top of funnel, and a lot of the times that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Acquisition channels, and some businesses will be a bit more retention, some will be a bit more product led. It's unique to every businesses. I feel like there's no one definition. It's hard to pin down.
No, I agree.
What about you, Jake?
I think somebody who gets shit done is a good one. I think for me, it just like you can distill it down to someone who can look at a business and understand what of all the things drives that business forward. Like what is the fundamental thing that business needs to do to get to the next one order, next one customer, next incremental, whatever. And then can look at everything as a whole and say, we can do some shit here, we can focus here, we can run some experiments here. And that's like marketing and product and pricing and the offering and all that kind of stuff. But I think no one can be, what's really interesting is that no one can be an expert in all of those areas. It's impossible. So I quite like that you'd have lots of people working in growth, and there'll be people that are like your classic T-shaped marketers, and there'll be people that who's like the down bit in a T. I'm sure that's got a name, but the down bit of a T is in product, or the, and then someone else who's down bit of the T is in like paid media, and someone else who's down bit of the T is in like pricing strategy. So that's why I think it's an interesting space to be. But yeah, I mean, it's a hard role to define.
Yeah, we're a jack of all trades, master of none.
Exactly. Yeah. Jack of all trades, master of growth.
Oh, even better. I have an English degree.
Kevin, what's your favorite? It can either be classic literature or modern literature.
South of the Border, West of the Sun by Murakami.
Oh, there you go.
A classic, is that OG? If you're into a reader, and if you're not, I would definitely recommend reading that.
Amazing. Look at that. Okay. We should ask everyone for their book recommendation.
That we would never read.
Well, no, I'm going to read it. I'm going to show you guys. I'm going to read it.
Do you read?
Do I read? I did read when I was commuting. It's the worst thing about COVID and being remote. I mean, my main source of reading was on the train, and now I don't read. So, well, sorry, now I don't commute, so I don't read as much. And it's shit.
Do you read a lot?
Do you find time to read, Kevin? Yeah.
I try to. Now I read on the train. But I'm reading a really cheesy book called How to Lead, which is kind of embarrassing when you're like, you start your new job, like you're reading a book called How to Lead.
Just don't take it into the office.
Yeah, exactly. I like stuff like just before I get in. I try to do what I can on the train. If it's not like absolutely rammed on the overground.
Yeah.
See, that's the best time. I feel like that's that was my like sacred time of doing nothing but just smashing through the Kindle. But
yeah.
You know,
I haven't read a book in the last 4 years, ever. I think.
Ever.
Yeah, you can correlate it with like having kids, right? It's like before kids you were reading, after kids you didn't read shit.
No, I wasn't reading much before kids either.
A good one to read is Crossing the Chasm. That's like a marketing growthy kind
of book.
That's a good one.
It's funny, like I don't read these books, but I know all these titles.
Oh yeah.
It's because they're constantly quoted on LinkedIn posts and stuff.
Oh, God. I revoke that statement, then. I don't want to be a LinkedIn influencer.
No, it's good.
What I think I want to get into to help me reading is audiobooks. Listen to them. I feel like I'm better at listening to podcasts and things like that. So maybe I just need to listen to books instead. That'll be better.
Maybe. I feel like if you were listening to a book, you got more chance of not concentrating on it, though.
I don't know. I'll try. I'll give it a try. My excuse in not reading books is like they're not in my first language. So, you know, it's like reading in English.
There's plenty of books in French, mate.
I want the truth. I don't want the translated version. I want the real words, you know? I want the real words.
Yeah, fair enough. I think I mentioned this before, but Headspace. The apps that like summarize books down into just like
Headway.
And then there's a few others like that. I signed up to that for a bit and I was like, this is really good, and I get the point, because any kind of non-fiction, in my opinion, is like 99% fluff and there's like one little piece of information in there, and it's really good at that. But the problem is you just like go through like 10 books in an hour and then you just can't remember any of it.
Oh, wow.
So that's the downside. I mean, maybe I just got... I mean, I've definitely got a bad memory anyway. But I think sometimes it's like you have to drill it in over and over again through like hundreds of pages of repetition before you realize that, oh, yeah, that is the key to loving yourself or whatever it is.
Yeah, I feel like I read the same pages like 3 times before I actually get what it's trying to tell me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Kevin.
There we go.
It's been great.
Guys, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
For stopping by.
I'll do the spicy version on part 2.
Oh, right.
We'll do. Okay. We'll do a spicy version in part 2.
Yeah, he's done a spicy version in his moving around camera and his shorts.
Man, I'm not going to do that ever again. That center stage effect on the camera, every time I move my head, it goes into my legs. For fuck's sake. It did it 2 or 3 times, and I'm like, what? It's fine, because nobody really watches it. There's only like 2 or 3 people watching it, so it's fine. Hi, guys.
You don't know. Everyone who's on Spotify might be watching it. You can't tell.
Yeah, I can see in the stats. There's only a few. I'm exaggerating. It's more than 2 or 3. There's like 20, 30 people watching it, and everyone else is listening. But still like 20, 30 people who might see my shorts.
You mean 20,000, right? Yeah, for any sponsors.
All right. Yeah, have a great evening.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, thank you, man. Appreciate you spending the evening with us.
Thanks, guys.